Spring 1862 was a dark time for the Confederacy, with defeats along the Mississippi River in Tennessee, defeats on the North Carolina Sounds, and a huge Union army was poised, ready to strike at Richmond. And then on March 8, 1862, out of the Elizabeth River will come the CSS Virginia, and on that day will prove the power of iron over wood and begin to change the fortunes of the Confederacy in 1862. Well, I'll tell you right now, this story begins way back in the early 1850s. Actually, it goes back a little further. Because, you know, we go through this tremendous evolution in naval warfare during the 19th century. It is sail to steam. You can just imagine how important that is, because steam power lets you go anywhere you want, and that is better than sail, I got to tell you, although I like to sail myself. But nevertheless, I have to say that this transition is not only about steam power, but it's also about how we utilize that steam power. And first, we use paddle wheels, and paddle wheels, you know, are not very good overall. They move your ship wherever you want. If you're used to be in a Navy, you like to fire at broadsides, and those paddle wheels take up too much room. But added to that, those paddle wheels, one good shot and you are dead in the water. And then also, the engine to run it is called a walking beam engine, sits up on the deck, one shot into that, and where are you? Dead in the water, right? That's the way we like all the enemy ships anyway. So the big thing is that two men, Francis Pettit Smith and John Ericsson, will develop in 1839 the screw propeller. Oh my gosh, everybody's happy because you can put all your engine systems beneath the waterline, therefore they're shockproof, and those screw propellers are far more efficient in moving a ship through the water. So we see that naval propulsion is changing so drastically. Another big change is going to be from shot to shell. Now, back during the Nelsonian era, you know, we fire a lot of broadsides at each other, but you know, each one of those cannonballs are kind of like a bowling ball, right? You know, it goes right down like that. So I really only get this row, okay, unless I'm real good and get a couple splinters. But you get explosive shell. And when it strikes the side of a ship, not only does it create a ragged hole, it also sends wooden splinters, iron splinters across the deck. That shell blowing up here, well, I'd have to talk to them. So the big thing is, it's devastating. And those explosive shells, even more so over, have explosive red sparks, right? And, you know, sparks in a wooden ship are not a very good thing. So shells are the what Henry Paxenhans, this brigadier general who tests and studies naval armament, he will say that they will make peace come to the world because no wooden ship can stand up to them. And this is all proved one day on November 3rd, 1853, in a little place called Sinope. And it's when the Russian fleet, seven ships all armed with shell guns, comes down and destroys a 13-ship Turkish fleet. Oh my gosh, this is tremendous. Here we recognize that all these wooden ships can't stand up to these explosive shells. And as you all know, the Battle of Sinope is going to result in the Crimean War. And during the Crimean War, we will see that the English and the French will support Turkey against the Russians. They'll actually try to besiege Sevastopol. Well, the big problem there is that the English and French ships can't really blockade Sevastopol because of the forts defending it. Well, what's going to happen is that the French and the English come up with a great idea to have iron case floating batteries. They only go about 3 knots, so they're towed into the Black Sea. But then when put in front of the forts at Kinburn, they will destroy the forts. Everybody wakes up in Europe and recognize iron is the answer. So we make another transition from wood to iron. The big trouble here in the United States is we don't pay attention to that. And when we lay down a new class of warships called the Merrimack class, they are going to be wooden sailing steam screw warships. Oh my gosh, that sounds like a lot. But, you know, basically, the Merrimack class, they're all about 300 feet in length. They have a screw propeller, and they also are fully rigged as a sailing ship. And generally, especially the first one, the Merrimack, which is going to be built between 1854 and 1857 in Charlestown Navy Yard, Boston Harbor, will have extremely sheer hull. When she is put into the water, she's proclaimed a novel example of naval architecture. However, I'll tell you, on her maiden voyage, they discover a lot of problems. Problem number one, you know, a warship like the Merrimack, 40 guns, actually, they have 38 9-inch Dahlgrens and then two 10-inch pivot guns right on their decks. Powerful warship. Well, I got to tell you, big problem is when you have a sheer hull and you get into a somewhat heavy sea, you begin to do what? You roll. And so as Catesby Ap Roger Jones, an ordnance expert on the ship who works with Matthew Fontaine Maury, will say she rolls so badly, you can't fire the guns. Whoops. Okay. And number two, when she sails, steams down to Cuba, her engine system breaks down. And as a result of that, she's sent back up to Charlestown Navy Yard. They rework her engines, but they still don't work very well. And so bad are those engines that she will be condemned and sent to Gosport Navy Yard in Portsmouth, Virginia in February 1860. And there she'll be placed in Rotten Row with all these other old warships like the 140-gun Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania was the largest wooden warship built by the U.S. Navy. There is the venerable United States frigate, the United States. Also there, the Raritan, Columbia. These are all old sailing ships that are rotting in the ways. Actually, the Pennsylvania is stuck in the mud. They have no plans of moving her anywhere. Well, Gosport Navy Yard is the largest Navy Yard in the United States in 1860, and it just so happens that she'll be commanded by a man who's known as Flag Officer Charles Stuart McCauley. McCauley is 67 years old. He's been in the U.S. Navy 55 years. Some people say he's gotten a little too old for service, but everyone all agrees he merely drinks too much, okay? Now, he's going to be there when the secession crisis comes full circle in 1861, and I'm here to tell you that he will get these orders from Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, on April 10th. You must do everything you can to defend the yard. You must do everything you can to defend the honor of the nation. You must do everything you can to get the Merrimack ready for sea. You must do all these things, but do nothing to anger the Virginians. I leave it all to your discretion. Well, you know, a drunken discretion, you know, I mean, yeah, you know. So, the big thing is that here we have the man at the flashpoint of this huge Navy Yard, and he doesn't get very good advice either, because of his 20 officers, 13 will join the Confederate Navy. So there's a saying, Commodore, have another drink, you know, and don't worry about it. Well, they get so worried about it that they send the chief engineer of the U.S. Navy, Benjamin Franklin Isherwood, down to Gosport. He actually, in a day and a half, gets the engine systems of the Merrimack up and running, and he goes to McCauley on April 19th, I can take this ship out to sea, or at least I can get her over to Fort Monroe. And Fort Monroe, you know, here's Gosport Navy Yard, and there's Fort Monroe. Glad you didn't tour up my map. And so you can see that this is important. Remember, we're trying to start a blockade, and the U.S. Navy does not have the effective ships to have a blockade. Right. The Merrimack would make it happen. However, McCauley says, no, you can't leave port. Well, Benjamin Franklin Isherwood sends a telegram up to Welles and saying, hey, you know, they won't let me go. So Welles organizes a task force commanded by Flag Officer Hiram Paulding, who at 73 years old, you know, and he's been in the Navy since he was 12, so you just add that up, and he outranks McCauley. So he gets a bunch of Marines, gets on the gunboat, the Pawnee goes down the Potomac, rushes to Fort Monroe. He gets to Fort Monroe right around noon, where he adds on more Massachusetts troops, and he gets more combustibles and everything. But however, as he takes his gunboat towards the mouth of the Elizabeth River. Smoke is coming from the yard because Macaulay has lost his nerve and he's set the yard ablaze, right? And I'll tell you, the ships in the harbor are burning. Ship houses containing the ship of the line New York burns like a crisp. I have to say, though, when they burn the Merrimack, they set her afire, but they also pull her seacocks. So my big question is, how well does a burning ship burn when it sinks, okay? Okay, there's some problems with this operation. Now, Macaulay gets up there, and he sets his men to work. They take hammers. There are almost 1,200 heavy cannon laying across the quay. They try to break off their trunnions. Doesn't work. They try to blow up the dry dock. However, a petty officer who has friends living in Portsmouth breaks the powder train, right? So it doesn't get blown up, you know, and it's tremendous. The foundry isn't blown up or anything. In fact, when the Federals escape from Gosport Navy Yard on board the Cumberland, towed by the Pawnee and the Yankee, another little gunboat, and they escape towards Fort Monroe, they leave behind what they think is total destruction. However, the next day, the Confederates come into Gosport Navy Yard, and they recognize they have the wherewithal to build a navy. In fact, the Lynchburg, Virginia newspaper says, "We have the ability to build an entire fleet of iron ships." That's the first time iron ships have been mentioned in the Civil War. And I will tell you right now, the Secretary of Navy for the Confederacy is a very brilliant individual. His name is Stephen Russell Mallory from Key West, Florida. Every morning he wakes up and has some champagne and oysters to start his day. Roly-poly, 5'6". I will say he understands Navy affairs because he had been serving as a senator from Florida, and he's chairman of the Senate's Committee on the Conduct of Naval Affairs. He knows all about those ironclads over in Europe. And he says that we must build a ship that heretofore has never been seen in naval warfare. We must build an iron ship with rifled guns and a ram. Oh my gosh, this is the first mention of these new tools of war here in America. Well, what's going to transpire is, Mallory, of course, is a politician. So he calls together the most brilliant naval minds in the Confederacy. John Mercer Brooke, who's actually used to work for Matthew Fontaine Maury. He is a brilliant scientist, and he will come up with the design of the new Confederate ironclad. Then they have naval constructor John Luke Porter, who knows how to take that concept and put it into drawings. And then they have chief engineer of the Confederate Navy, William Price Williamson, who will understand engine systems. Now, when they get together up in Richmond, actually, John Mercer Brooke comes up with this plan: submerged ends, a casemate with 36-degree angle to help deflect shot. He also comes up with an idea: this time I'm going to make a rifle cannon, and not only am I going to make a rifle cannon, I'm going to make one that can fire solid shot, I'm going to make one that can fire explosive shell, and one that can fire armor-piercing shot, okay? Because he says, if I'm going to build an ironclad, I surely want to know how to sink one. You know, so this guy is really on, he's high tech. Okay, so we have him. Then John Luke Porter says, well, you know, I can take that design. We can make it here in the South. And William Price Williamson says, well, we might be able to build the ship, but we can't build the engines to go in the ship. And then Porter says, well, what about them engines in the Merrimack? And they said, great. We'll take that plan and we'll apply it to the Merrimack. And what they will do is they will cut her down to her berth deck, bring her into the dry dock, and then begin this transition that goes from June till March of 1862, turning this vessel into an ironclad. And I'm going to pause just for a moment because, you know, there's a lot of names associated with this Confederate ironclad. And I'm here to say that the ship really is called the Merrimack at the very beginning as a Union ship when she gets burned, and you should always spell it with a K, right? Because it's named for the Merrimack River in New Hampshire, right? And not the Merrimack River in Massachusetts. And we know that for sure because Franklin Pierce, who was from Merrimack County, New Hampshire, signed the bill to pay for the ship. And you look at all the sail plans, which I've looked at, there it says USS Merrimack. So not only do a lot of people misspell it, but also the ship is going to be recommissioned on February 17, 1862, as the CSS Virginia. As one of her crew members, William Norris, said, "Virginia is her name, that sweet, sonorous song, Virginia, not that northerly, nasally twang, Merrimack. Because in Virginia, she was made by Virginian hands with Virginian wood, and in Virginia waters, she created a record that would forevermore bring honor to Virginia." Well, yeah, huzzah, right? Okay, now, I had to get that out of the way. Now, let's get into a little bit of technical stuff because there's a lot of fun stuff to get into. Now, basically, the casemate is going to contain 10 guns, and the forward and aft guns are going to be 7-inch Brooke guns on pivot mount. Then the first broadside guns back will be 6.4-inch Brooke guns, and then there'll be 3 9-inch Dahlgrens per side going down the gun deck. Those 9-inch Dahlgrens, two of them, right near the funnel, are going to be specially fitted to fire hot shot. Okay, and you know, hot shot is usually, if you have a 9-inch Dahlgren, you got an 8-inch shot, you heat it up red hot, you get your barrel, of course, you got to do this carefully, and you put the gunpowder in, a dry sabot, and then a wet sabot. You load her up and fire. In fact, the guy who's in command of those two guns, John Randolph Eggleston, said, "I really love to skip them in the water, you know, and actually he'd skip them up into the hull of a vessel." Well, that's death knell for wooden warships. And then on their bow is a 1,500-pound cast iron ram. Because, you know, as Mallory reflected, we don't have a lot of gunpowder in the Confederacy. We're going to be a shot-proof ship, and so we can just go around ramming everybody, because the ram in a naval warship is like a bayonet charge of infantry. Well, you know, they haven't used rams in warfare since 1571, and that's the Battle of Lepanto, where Don Juan of Austria will destroy this Turkish fleet. The Turks all want to ram the Christian fleet, and Don Juan of Austria has cannon, so the Turks don't get their way, you know? And that kind of taught everyone, we can't do that anymore. Now Mallory knows we can, because we have steam power and we have 2 layers of 2-inch iron plate on the side of our casemate, backed by 24 inches of oak pine, well, yellow oak, white pine, and yellow pine. And I'll tell you, this is really amazing backing because it's giving the casemate a little give to it, which is important because people want to hurl heavy shot at your sides. Now, and they'll crack and everything. Now, I want to tell you, they reworked the engines, some that somehow they're going to work. And actually, by the end of February, this ship is about ready. I mean, it's hard getting the iron there, not only making the iron at Tredegar Ironworks, but more so over getting it from Richmond down to Hampton Roads. Now, at the end of February, the ship will get its commander, and her commander is going to be one of the most dynamic naval officers in, well, I would say in the whole United States. And his name happens to be Franklin Buchanan. Franklin Buchanan was born in Baltimore, Maryland on September 17th, 1800. He's 5'10", bald, hawk-nosed. This guy was said no finer man tread a quarterdeck since Nelson. That's saying an awful lot. This guy was the first superintendent of the United States Naval Academy. He was a hero in the Mexican War. He went with Perry to Japan and has said that he is the first senior naval officer to step foot on Japanese soil. He was in command of the Susquehanna. And I'll tell you, when the Susquehanna is going in Edo Bay, now called Tokyo Bay, the Susquehanna runs aground. And, of course, they have this Chinese pilot. And purportedly, Buchanan turns around and shoots this look across the deck that feared the Chinese pilot so much, he jumped overboard rather than to have the wrath of Buchanan. Well, at the outbreak of the war, Buchanan is commandant of the Washington Naval Yard. And actually, 1 week before the war begins, his daughter is marrying a Marine officer known as Julius Meir, and they have a great party at the Washington Naval Yard. Stephen Douglas comes, Gideon Wells comes, Abraham Lincoln comes, okay? So here you have all these fine people here, and Gideon Wells tells Lincoln, you must beware of Buchanan's Southern tendencies. And he should have, because one of Buchanan's daughters, Fanny, is running around, and she's 13 years old, but she's very well endowed, and she has a Confederate flag sewn into her bodice, you know? So that's kind of telling what side they're on. Well, let me tell you that when the Baltimore riots occur on April 19th, 1862, Buchanan resigns his commission. However, as you all know, Maryland is stopped from leaving the Union, and as a result of that, Buchanan, right, Gideon Wells, I might have been a little hasty. Can I have my job back? I just don't want to fight against my Southern brethren. Well, Gideon Wells writes across the letter, you are dismissed from the service. You are a traitor. Whew. Buchanan, like any good free agent, joins the Confederate Navy. And he'll be head of the Offices of Orders and Details. And as a result of that, he will send down to Gosport Navy Yard some of the finest officers to serve in the Confederate Navy. John Taylor Wood, grandson of Zachary Taylor, right? Also, Catesby Ap Roger Jones, who serves as executive officer. Hunter Davison, a gunnery expert who had served as a professor at the Naval Academy. Also, people like Charles Carroll Sims, who had gone to with Buchanan to every one of Buchanan's posts since he had served in Mexico. Well, we have these outstanding officers. One of my favorite is John Randolph Eggleston. And also, well, Ashton Ramsey, chief engineer of the vessel. This vessel has the finest officer corps. They have one-third of the crew is shipped as actually prior's naval service, but the rest of them are going to be kind of infantrymen. You know, actually, John Taylor Wood, because not only is he grandson of Zachary Taylor, he's nephew of Jefferson Davis, right? And so, you know, he can go in any Confederate camp and say, guess who I am? And they all have to pay attention. So he recruits members, but when they all show up to be in the crew, they're not the ones he picked. They're men in chains and on sick lists. But Catesby Jones says, we're going to take off those chains. We're going to make you healthy because we're going to let you begin anew. Men, you will be men. And, you know, none of those people that joined the crew, and I tracked every one of them, and they do not cause any trouble. It's really kind of amazing, you know, having a fresh start. Well, I have to tell you the ship is ready for service, but not enough crew members. Actually, Catesby Jones has to go over to Fort Norfolk, which is right over here, and from Gosport Navy Yard, and he meets with Thomas Kevel, who's commander of this artillery unit known as the United Artillery. He says, look, we need more cannoneers. And he takes his whole crew command and joins the crew of the Virginia. Also, all those Marines on there, led by a great Mexican War hero, Reuben Tom, will actually man gun crews also. That's how desperate the situation is. Because Buchanan knows he has an ironclad and knows he wants to strike at the Federals. Now, on March 6th, he's ready to go. But a terrible gale comes through Hampton Roads. And as a result of that, you know, he has to wait. But the morning of March 8th, 1862, was a beautiful day that dawned in Virginia. Not a cloud in the sky, not a ripple on Hampton Roads. And it was a perfect day for the Virginia to go on her shakedown cruise, because that's what everyone's going to say. We're going to go test the vessel. Now, I want to say, everyone's kind of worried about the ship. William Norris said, with each stroke of the engine, we didn't know whether we were going to go forward, stop dead in the water, or turn turtle, okay? Because all that 790 tons of iron on top had compro-quitted her stability with that great sheer hull. She has a 22-foot draft, so she can only go so many places. Added to that, she was called as navigable as Noah's Ark, okay? It took her a half hour to turn around. So, nevertheless, at 11:30 on the morning of March 8th, Buchanan orders the workmen off the vessel and for the ship to go down on her shakedown cruise. Thousands of people line the waterbank, cheering and huzzahing to see the ship go through the water. Many people, you know, You get a piece of wood, throw it on the water, what does it happen? It floats. Get a piece of iron and throw it on the water, what does it do? Sink. And that's what some of these people think. In fact, one person, according to this midshipman Hardin Littlepage, shouted from the shore, "Go on with your metallic coffin. You'll never amount to a thing." Well, when Buchanan gets down to Craney Island, right here, and here's Hampton Roads. And in Hampton Roads are these powerful Union warships, the Cumberland 24 guns, a sailing sloop of war. The sailing frigate, the Congress, 52 guns. The steam screw frigate, the 47-gun Minnesota. The 42-gun steam screw frigate, the Roanoke, and the 50-gun sailing frigate, the St. Lawrence. That's 215 guns. Plus, we have the Union forts of Camp Butler, Fort Monroe, and Fort Calhoun. So Buchanan gets his ship right around here, right? And he slows the engines down and he says, "Men, today we will do our duty, not just our duty, but more than our duty. Today we will attack the Union fleet. Some of you all have complained I have not taken you close to the enemy. I will take you there now. To your cannons, to your death, we will sink before surrender." You can imagine the crew. What? You know? This is a shakedown cruise, you know? In fact, Dinwiddie Phillips, a surgeon on board the vessel, goes up to Buchanan and says, "Captain Buchanan, how can we attack the Union fleet today? Our ship is untried." And Buchanan purportedly said, "If we sink the Federal fleet today, we know our ship is a success. If they sink us, we're deed a failure." And with that, into the harbor comes the CSS Virginia. There's a lookout on the Minnesota who shouts down to the officer of the deck, "Sir, you need to take a glass and look over there, because I think that thing's a-coming," right? They said she looked like a floating barn roof with a chimney belching smoke. Another person said she appeared like a half-huge submerged crocodile, intent on evil. Well, the Virginia has to follow the shoal or line, and she has to go like this, and then she cuts over like this to head around to the Cumberland. When she passes the Congress fires a broadside at the Virginia, and the shot bounces off the side of the Virginia like pebbles thrown against a brick wall. In fact, all the gun crew in the forward 7-inch Brook gun, they all, when the shot hits the side of the Virginia, they all duck, right? And Charles Carroll Sims says, "Be men. I've taken shot in open air worse than that, you know." But they all of a sudden realize, oh my gosh, it works. Yeah. Well, they fire a salvo of 4 shots back at the Congress. Hot shot and shell rumbles through the side of the Congress, critically wounding the vessel. In fact, as the Virginia steams by, it is said that brain, blood, and bone is flowing from the scuppers of the Congress. Well, Buchanan doesn't want to stay there and finish that ship off. He wants to get the Cumberland, because the Cumberland purportedly had a 70-pounder rifled gun on board, the only gun that Buchanan really figured is going to do his ship damage. So he goes straight after the Cumberland, kind of going like this. He rams the Cumberland in her starboard forward quarter, and it's said that she created a hole large enough for a horse and cart to ride through. Well, immediately, the Cumberland is doomed. Robert Dabney Minor, flag lieutenant, runs down the gun deck shouting, "Our cleaver has cut her open." However, down in the engine room, third assistant engineer E.A. Jack will say, "I was sitting on a coal shuttle when I felt our ship shudder when we struck the enemy's vessel. But then I felt our ship take on a decidedly dangerous tilt." That's right. Buchanan orders the engines in reverse. And remember those engines, formerly condemned? They spent 6 weeks in the saltwater Elizabeth River. Not good. And so what's going to happen? The engines don't go into reverse. She's stuck into the Cumberland. John Randolph Eggleston will shout, "Like a wasp, we can only sting but once." However, a swell comes, turning the Virginia. The weight of the Congress is on the ram, and the ram breaks off. The Virginia floats away. And I will say that at this moment is going to be the fiercest naval combat of the Civil War. The Cumberland two-thirds of her out of the water, and George Uphan Morris, her commander, keeps his men at the guns as they pound at the Virginia. In fact, the Virginia receives most of her damage in these 2 days' battles from the Cumberland. They knock off two muzzles of the Confederate guns. They crack some plates. The smokestack is riddled so much that Dinwiddie Phillips says a flock of crows could fly through. And I'll tell you, up in the, here's this 36 slope degree, right? Which there's this great book, which is, if you have his insomnia, you should read it. It's by John Gross Bernard, who's later chief engineer of the Army of the Potomac. He has notes on seacoast of defense and how you're supposed to slope your armor, 36 degrees. But to make it work even better, you got to put something slippery on top of it. So Catesby Jones had the outer casemate of the Virginia coated with ship's grease, tallow and pig fat. So can you imagine, there are these two sailors on the 7-inch Brooke gun, forward Brooke gun, John Hunt and Jack Cronin, and John turns to Jack and says, what it smells like? You got bacon fat, you got coal smoke, and you got gunpowder, right? So John turns to Jack and says, don't it smell like hell? And the answer is, and we'll soon be there. Because a moment before, Charles Dunbar and that own gun crew, you hear all this stuff going on, you can't see. He pokes his head out the gun port, and that's right when a Union shell will strike and his body comes back in headless. Oh, geez, but I have to tell you, after a half hour, the Cumberland begins to slip beneath the waves as her commander, Lieutenant George Uphan Morris, begins to shout to the crew, give them another broadside, boys, as we go. And the Cumberland sinks, her flag flying, defeated yet defiant. Well, this is the moment, 3:30 in the afternoon of March 8th, where we see the Virginia prove the power of iron over wood. Wooden ships are no longer wanted. It's ironclads. Well, the Virginia takes a half hour to turn around. As she makes that turn, she destroys two transports along the wharf. Then she sends some shots up into Camp Butler, including one that goes to the headquarters of the commander of Camp Butler, a man known as Brigadier General Joseph King Fenno Mansfield, a graduate of West Point class of 1819. He is hopping mad. No one likes to get showered with splinters. So, anyway, the Virginia turns around, comes back, and the Congress has since run aground. Well, the Virginia gets within 150 feet, begins pounding the Congress for a half hour, and she drops her colors. She surrenders. In fact, her commander, Lieutenant Joseph Smith, has been hit by a shell fragment and killed. Well, Buchanan now is really happy, Sank one ship, I got another one right here, sank a couple of transports. He's having fun, It's said that he got a little excitable in battle. Well, and there's one thing I want to tell you. If you're fighting in an ironclad, stay inside. But not Buchanan. He gets out of the hatch. He's on top of the ship. He orders these two tugs, arm tugs, the Raleigh and the Beaufort, to go alongside the Congress, get the wounded off, and get her surrender, and then burn the ship. Well, when William Parker, commander of the Raleigh, gets alongside, he steps on the deck of the Congress, he there sees his roommate from Annapolis, Joseph Smith's shoulder strap bloodied on the ground, and the decks were slippery with brains and blood. It was terrible. But all of a sudden, shots come from Camp Butler, this little base right here. The Union soldiers are shooting at the Congress, and, Parker tells his men to leave. They back away. Buchanan's watching all this. He says, you're not supposed to do that. He gets Robert Dabney Minor into a little ship's boat. They row over towards the Congress. But I will tell you right now, they are shot as they're way there. Buchanan now is really hopping mad. They're firing on that white flag. So actually, when Mansfield tells his men to do that, one of his officers comes up to him and says, General Mansfield, we can't fire on that white flag. And Mansfield says, look, I haven't surrendered, have I? And so they keep doing it. Well, Buchanan doesn't like this. He begins shooting at the Union soldiers on the shore. Well, of course they notice, and they will shoot him. They shoot him in the hip, grievously wounded. He is taken below onto the gun deck. He shouts to the crew, do not worry, men. The wound is not mortal. I will soon be back amongst you. And then he turns to his executive officer, Catesby Ap Roger Jones, and says, Plug that ship full of hotshot, fill her full of hotshot till she glows. Giving that order, knowing his brother, Lieutenant Commander Thomas McKean Buchanan, is on board. Well, after a half hour, the Congress is burning stem to stern, and the Virginia now heads back out of the James River into Hampton Roads. However, the tide is falling. It's getting dark. Now, meanwhile, these ships have all come over here. I had a pen. Yeah. I thought I did. Wait a second. These ships had all come over here, and trying to get there, they run aground on what's called the Hampton Bar. This one does, and this one does. Okay? The Minnesota is right here, and she is a sitting duck as the Virginia comes back in like this. But because the tide's going out, they send shot into her and shot into the St. Lawrence, damaging both vessels, and then she comes back here to a little buoy, right? Now, it's about 8 o'clock, and I will tell you, the Congress is sending an eerie glow across Hampton Roads, and all of a sudden, a little miracle happens, because in through the capes comes the USS Monitor. And the Monitor, of course, has another unique story, but basically, she's a ship that almost wasn't built. She's the brainchild of a man known as John Ericsson. And Ericsson, Swedish-American, had actually invented the screw propeller. A man known as Commander Robert Stockton, learns about Ericsson, brings him to America, and they build the first steam screw frigate known as the Princeton. And she's launched in 1844 in January. She's a beautiful ship. All the guns are designed by Ericsson, except for one, which was this huge 13-inch shell gun. Now, I got to tell you, it's nicknamed the Peacemaker. Now, Ericsson says, you know, that gun's not good. In fact, if you fire it too many times, it's going to burst. Stockton says, you're just jealous because my gun's bigger than yours. And so, really. And so when Stockton leaves New York, he tells Ericsson the wrong time to be at the dock. And Ericsson comes down there, and there's the Princeton going away. Yeah. Stockton wanted to take all the glory. Well, I got to tell you, when they get down to the Washington Navy Yard, everybody's happy. It's February 29, 1844, and they have a big party on the Princeton. You know, they go out into the river. All the senators are drinking, you know, firing guns. What more fun could they have? Actually, His Excellency John Tyler is there, and he has the hots for this young 21-year-old girl named Julia Gardner, whose father is a congressman. And Tyler invites her for a special tour of the captain's cabin while the guys are up there drinking and firing cannon. And all of a sudden, they all said, let's fire that big one again, right? And they fire it, and it blows up. Julia goes, wow. They do get married. I want to tell you. They do get married. But I'll tell you, senators are killed. Beverly Kenyon, the chief of naval construction, is killed. The naval secretary is killed. And when it's time to say whose fault it was for the explosion, guess who Stockton blames it on? Ericsson, that's right. And he becomes a pariah. And so when the Civil War comes and the Federals, you know, there's no secrecy during the Civil War. You know, the newspapers in the South, we're building an ironclad, aren't we good? You know, and the Yankees don't have anyone, you know, So the basically the Federals said, we're going to have to build an ironclad. And so what they do is they set up an ironclad board. And a bunch of old school naval officers, Hiram Paulding, Joe Smith of the Congress, his father is on this board, as well as Charles Henry Davis. And they're all old school. They like wooden ships, you know. They don't even like steam power. But so anyway, they're reviewing these ironclads, and they pick one design called the New Ironsides. Then they pick another one called the Galena. But they have some questions about its stability. And the guy backing the Galena project is a man known as Cornelius Bushnell. Wealthy, knows all the politicians, supported the Republicans, friend of Gideon Wells. And so when he goes in there, they say, well, look, we don't like the stability. You have to answer these questions. And Bushnell says, well, you know, I'm a financier. I'll go find out for you. And as he's leaving, he sees a friend of his who's Congressman Thomas Rowland. And Rowland says, you know, you ought to go see this crazy guy up in Brooklyn I know, John Erickson. I bet you he can answer anything you need. So up goes Bushnell. He goes, sees Erickson. He brings the plans to the vessel, shows them to Erickson. Erickson goes, yeah, you know, this is why it will work. But it's not very good. Let me show you what I have. He goes in the closet, pulls out this cardboard model of the monitor. You know, Bushnell's eyes light up. He says, why didn't you put that into the competition for an ironclad? And, you know, Erickson says, well, you know, the Navy doesn't like me. He says, well, I'll fix that. So he takes the model, he sends a couple of telegrams to some friends, and he goes down to the ironclad board, he answers the question, then he pulls out of a box the monitor. Charles Henry Davis goes, what is that? If I believed in idolatry, I'd take that out and worship it. It's something a sailor's eyes have never looked upon before. And, you know, Cornelius Bushnell says, it's this great ironclad designed by John Erickson. And I'll go, oh my gosh, no. And into the room at that moment comes Abraham Lincoln. That's who he sent those telegrams to, you know. And Abraham Lincoln comes in, takes a look at it, and he says, you know, it kind of reminds me of that country girl when she first puts her foot in a silk stocking and exclaims, there's really something in it. Well, you know, they kind of look around. They say, well, we got some questions, and we don't like it, but he does, so you better answer these questions. So Bushnell hops on a train, goes back up to Brooklyn, says, look, they love you. They love your plans, but they had some questions I can't answer. You need to go down there and answer them. So you can imagine old Erickson, who's an egotist to begin with, goes down to the ironclad boardroom. The next day, comes in, and the, you know, especially Davis, who hated Erickson, says, what are you doing here? And Erickson says, well, I thought you liked my ironclad, and I thought you wanted to hear all about it. And Davis says, we don't like it. We don't like you. And Erickson then launches into a half-hour soliloquy of the power of the little ship. Hiram Paulding says, I've been at sea for over 60 years, and I never learned so much information about stability, buoyancy, and seamanship. They gave him a contract, right? Uh-huh. And so, but he's got to build the ship in 100 days. He rushes back to New York. He subcontracts all these projects out. I mean, they were making the iron plate for the turret is actually made in Baltimore at Abbott Ironworks. Troy builds iron bars for the pilot house. I mean, it's all sent out and all gets reassembled at Greenpoint Shipyard. Well, the great thing is the monitor will finally be launched on the end of January 31st, 1862, excuse me. Everyone's saying she's going to go right to the bottom. So Erickson's standing on the bow as she slips down the ways, you know, and the ship floats. So what's going to happen is that the monitor takes some time. Her commander is going to be a man known as John Lomer Worden, who is an ordnance expert. He actually was the first naval POW of the Civil War. And he actually goes down to Pensacola and on a special mission about the Warrenton Shipyard and Fort Pickens. And, you know, Florida, while he's there, leaves the Union. And he says, well, I've done my job. I'm going to go back to Washington. When's the train? And they said, don't go on the train. He goes, I'm going to go on the train. And he's in his uniform. And he says, I'm going to take me to the train. Don't wear the uniform if you're going to go on the train. I'm going to wear the uniform. Well, of course, he gets captured, and he ends up the first naval POW. So anyway, recently released, when he sees the monitor, he says, I am willing to be the agent to prove this vessel a success. Well, you can imagine the monitor, there's nothing like it. It's got a 18-inch freeboard, which is an armor belt. Then there's the turret, which has 8 layers of 1-inch iron plate. Inside are 2 11-inch Dahlgrens. Then there's a pilot house forward. That is the only way you can really see out of the vessel. Everything else of the vessel is beneath the waterline, you know. Worden actually goes and recruits men as volunteers and to come on board the monitor. Actually, 2 of them, when they finally show up to ship on the monitor, they steal the cutter and desert, you know. And so, I mean, you live underneath the water. I want to tell you, William Keeler, the paymaster on board the ship, will say he's in his little snuggery, his little cabin, and they have these little deck lights. They unscrew these, you know, the deck plates so that you can have light coming down into your cabins. Well, he says, I got a little concerned when I saw water over top with fish. You know, and so, you know, that's right. And he called it my submarine life. Well, nevertheless, after trials, the Monitor finally is ready to go. In fact, she'll leave New York on March 6, 1862, coming down the coast off of the coast of New Jersey. She's struck by that same gale that kept the Virginia in port. And that gale almost sinks the Monitor twice. In fact, when they finally get down to the Virginia Capes, Samuel Dana Green, the executive officer, says, I feel as if I've lived 10 good years. Well, I want to tell you, as they come into the Virginia Capes, they will actually say, Worden will see all these ships coming out of Hampton Roads. And he says it looked like a flock of chickens chased by a fox, because you could see the explosions in the distance. Well, he steams in at darkness, and he goes up next to the Roanoke, which is commanded by John Marsden, who's acting commander, while Lewis Goldsborough is down in North Carolina with Burnside during the Roanoke Island expedition. And Marsden says, look, I got a telegram from New York saying you're supposed to, or from Washington saying you're supposed to go there. But I think you need to stay here, because let me tell you, there's telegraph at Camp Butler that goes to Fort Monroe, that crosses the bay to Cape Charles, goes all the way up to Wilmington, Delaware, then comes down to Washington. 4 hours after an event happens, Lincoln knows all about it. In fact, when Lincoln learns of the sinking of the Congress in Cumberland, he will say it is the greatest calamity to strike the Union since Bull Run. Well, what will transpire now is that the Monitor, Marsden, says, you're going to stay here. You need to go next to the Minnesota. She's run aground. We can't get her off. You need to defend her. So Worden takes his vessel over there. You know, the Monitor is 9 feet off the water's edge. The Minnesota's 45 feet off the water's edge. So Worden gets on top of the turret, hails up to the commander of the Minnesota, 47-year naval veteran, Captain Gershon Henry Jacques Van Brunt. Van Brunt looks down the side of his vessel as Worden hails to him and says, what are you? And Worden says, I'm the Monitor, and I'm here to protect you. And Van Brunt looks back down, and he says, look, I don't know what you can do or what you will do. If that thing comes back tomorrow, I will fight my ship, and I will sink before surrender. Worden merely says, I will protect you. The next morning at about 6:30, they beat to quarters on the Virginia. The men are given a breakfast of 2 boiled eggs and 2 jiggers of whiskey and get ready to go back out into Hampton Roads.
Breakfast of champions.
Isn't that how you start? So anyway, what will happen is that there's a fog on Hampton Roads, so they have to delay. Around 8 o'clock, she steams into the roads. As soon as she gets within 2,000 yards, Charles Carroll Sims screams a shot through the rigging of the Minnesota, reloading very quickly. They'll fire another shot that slams into the hull. But they all notice what looks like a barge alongside of the Minnesota, which they think they're just trying to take stuff up to lighten her. Well, when that thing put on steam and came towards them and fired. K.P. Jones knows what it is. He says it's the Erickson Battery. Because I want to tell you, the January 1862 issue of Scientific American magazine has the plans of the Monitor in it. And K.P. Jones has still delivered his copy, you know, because he's a subscriber, you know. Why break things up, you know? So, in fact, the Confederates knew. They announced the Monitor sailing in the New York Times. So, you know, there's not a lot of secrets going on, and I tell you. So, nevertheless, you know, Jones recognizes that he has the wrong ammunition because the Confederates thinking they're just going to fight wooden warships. So those armor-piercing shot are up in Richmond. They didn't need them. So Jones knows he's got to get at the Minnesota. Worden knows he's got to keep them away from the Minnesota. So the ships for the next 4.5 hours will fight in concentric circles. After the first hour, the Monitor breaks off action, goes off on the shoal to reload ammunition to her turret. The Virginia tries to go after the Minnesota. She'll run aground. The Monitor then comes alongside of her and pounds her. See, there's some problems on the Monitor. Number one, the speaking tube between the pilot house and the turret does not work, filled with water. Yeah? And so they have to get runners to go back through the ship to tell them where to fire. Because when you're in the turret, you cannot see out, right? And so they pick two people to be the runners, William Keeler from Illinois, another one, Daniel Toffey, who's nephew of Worden, never been on a ship before. So, you know, when Worden says you need to fire 5 points to starboard, you know, Toffey will run through the ship, you know, panning, goes up into the turret and says, you need to fire 5 points to westward, you know, and so there's a little confusion. Now, plus, there are these white marks inside the turret where you're supposed to stop on the commands of the captain, stop, fire your guns. Well, as you all know, 11-inch Dahlgrens leave a lot of black powder residue, so they can't see the white marks. Now, the next problem is the turret has its own little engine, and so when you turn her on, you know, she starts to spin, and then you're supposed to be able to stop her so she can stop and fire. Well, the trouble is they can't turn her off with any accuracy, so this thing, they have to start firing on the fly, right? Basically, Samuel Dana Green will look over the guns like this, and when he sees an object in front, he'll step back and they'll fire. Well, the trouble is the pilot house is up here at the same level as those Dahlgrens. It's called monitor roulette, but nothing happens. Well, finally, the Virginia gets off the mud bank. I'll tell you, there's all sorts of problems on the Virginia also. Number one, she's got the wrong ammunition. Actually, during the battle, Catesby at Roger Jones is walking down the gun deck, and he sees John Randolph Eggleston standing behind his gun, snapping his finger. He says, "What is the meaning of this, sir? Why are you not firing your gun?" And Eggleston says, "I find I can do as much damage to that ship by snapping my fingers as by firing my guns because powder is precious, sir." Well, you know, Jones walks away. Then John Taylor Wood comes up to him and says, "I know how we're going to get her. I got a bunch of volunteers. We're going to get right next to her. We're going to hop on board of her. I'm going to take off our coats. We're going to stick them down her funnels to back up and stop her draw for her engines. We're going to put our coats over the pilot house. And I got a bunch of chloroform. We're going to throw it in there and we'll take her by boarding, sir." You know, they never do it. But it is kind of amazing. Well, Jones decides that he wants to try and ram the monitor. He builds up speed. He runs at her, but the monitor has an evasive action. The Virginia barely hits her, damages her own bow, leaving splinters of wood in the side because they don't know what they're missing. The ram, right? So Worden, seeing the Virginia starting to rise a little high out of the water, decides the best thing he can do is ram the propeller of the Virginia because that will disable her. He builds up speed, runs at the fantail of the Virginia. At the very last moment, there's a steering malfunction. She veers off, and at that, John Taylor Wood will fire his 7-inch Brooke gun. The shell blows off the top of the pilot house, and Worden falls out of it, saying, "I am blinded, I am killed." Well, Peter Williams, the only crew member of the Monitor to receive the Medal of Honor, will take the ship onto a shoal as Worden is taken to his cabin. Then they say, "Well, we got to have someone in charge." So they send up back up in the turret to get Samuel Dana Green, 21 years old, a recent graduate of the United States Naval Academy. He comes down, goes, sees Worden, and he says, "What am I to do?" And Worden says, "Don't worry about me. You know, I'm dying. I'm blinded. Save the Minnesota." Now, meanwhile, the Virginia, happy as can be, they see the Monitor go off onto a shoal. So what they do is they start heading towards the Minnesota, but the pilots are saying, "The tide's going out. We're going to get stuck. We need to go back." And so the Virginia goes back into the Elizabeth River just as the Monitor comes back into action. And the Battle of Ironclads is over. You know, this is an inconclusive battle, but it has far-reaching implications. The Monitor may have stopped the Virginia from sinking any more wooden warships. However, the Virginia's mere existence will change the balance of power in Tidewater, Virginia, during the Peninsula Campaign, because George Britton McClellan is hell-bent about getting out of Washington, D.C., and he will come down to Fort Monroe anyway, and he can't use the James River. He has to focus on the York, and of course, as you know, John Bankhead Magruder had built the series of fortifications in which McClellan decides he's going to have to besiege because Magruder puts on this great parade of strength, you know, saying instead of having 13,000 men, McClellan will say that Magruder has 200,000 yes. men defending the position. I mean, he marches his troops up and down, you know. In fact, Mary Boykin Chestnut will say, it's amazing how Magruder paraded his 10,000 men before McClellan like fireflies and deluded him. Well, the reason why that worked was because of the existence of the Virginia. The commander of the North Atlantic blockading squadron, Louis Malchibrez Goldsborough, 5'10". 340 pounds. He didn't do anything fast, right? He said at one meal he ate an entire chicken and then consumed a huge watermelon, pounced his stomach going, monsterly good. Well, he's suffering a dreaded disease in 1862 called ram fever or Merrimack on the brain. He thinks that Confederate ironclad is more powerful than it is. So he says, I cannot do anything but keep the monitor to guard against the Virginia. I can't run past those water batteries at Yorktown and Gloucester Point. So that gives McClellan an entire month delay. In fact, Lincoln gets so tired of these delays, he calls McClellan the Virginia Creeper, and he will actually come down to Fort Monroe, and he meets with the commander of Fort Monroe, General Wool, and Louis Goldsborough. And he says, what's going on? Why aren't we in the James River? And, you know, Goldsborough shudders, I guess, while he's eating a drumstick and saying, look, we can't do that because of the Virginia. And Lincoln says, well, have you ever thought of capturing Norfolk? A little light bulb goes off. And, you know, they said, oh, well, we can't do that. Well, Lincoln says, yes, we can. So he convinces Goldsborough that he's going to send the monitor, the Naugatuck, another very bad ironclad, just iron hull and 100-pounder parapet and parapet, to go against Sewell's Point while the Galena goes into the James River. The Virginia is going to have to make a choice when she comes out. Now, the Virginia has a new commander now. His name is Josiah Tatnall, 67 years old. He's been in the U.S. Navy since he was 13, a hero at the Battle of Craney Island in 1813. He is the man that coined the phrase, blood is thicker than water, when he's serving during the Opium Wars and actually uses his ships to save some British ships that run aground. Well, he's a great naval hero, and when he sees the monitor, he brings his ship out of the Elizabeth River. He tells his men, we are going to take her. We'll take the monitor, even if hell's on the other side of her. You go to your battle stations, I'll go to mine. He climbs out on deck and sits in a chair as the Virginia's heading towards the monitor, right? Well, you know, you've got to show your bravery, I guess. And what will happen, basically, is the monitor retreats. Lincoln is beside himself. He then goes in a little boat onto the shore at Ocean View. He will find a place to land. He goes back and sees Wool. Land your troops there. They march on Norfolk on May 10th. Norfolk surrenders without telling the Virginia, right? Virginia's out there at Craney Island. All of a sudden, the Confederates are gone. Well, what am I going to do, Tatnall says. He tells his officers, let's go out and go down game, take on the entire Union fleet. They all say, wait a second. You know, they might damage our ship. They might capture it. That's not good. So Tatnall says, let's take her out to sea and go down to Savannah. Wait a second. You know, we're not seaworthy, right? And so Tatnall says, let's lighten the vessel. Well, they try because, you know, the Virginia has a draft of 22 feet and there are shoals in the river that are 18 feet, even at high tide. They work feverishly. But by 1 o'clock in the morning, the pilots say, the wind's blowing from the wrong direction. So as a result of that, Tatnall will order his ship to be run aground and given to the flames. As Richard Curtis, one of the crew members, said, what a sad finish to such a bright beginning. Lincoln actually watches the explosion of the Virginia, and he'll merely quip to one of his aides, she had been a thorn in our side for a long time, but now she is gone. And this prompts the monitor and the Naugatuck and the Galena and the Roostock, a wooden gunboat, and another one known as the Port Royal, to go up the James River. But fortunately, the crew of the Virginia will get to a train in Suffolk. They go up to a place called Drury's Bluff, a 90-foot bluff. And there, along with the Southside Artillery and the Bedford Artillery, on May 15, they'll stop the Union fleet. The Galena is proven to be a terrible ironclad. She's hit 33 times, holed 13 times. The monitor can't elevate its guns high enough to shoot up into the bluff. Well, the Virginia crew feels they've gotten revenge. However, the monitor will continue to serve, but it doesn't last through 1862. In fact, on December 25th, 1862, she will be given orders to go to Beaufort, North Carolina, to which Samuel Dana Green will say, "This is not an ocean-going vessel," right? And so en route there, early morning on December 31st, 1862, the Monitor sinks off of Cape Hatteras. I'll tell you, these two ships created a naval revolution that will define ship design for the next 90 years. The Virginia, sloped armor, rifled guns, rams. Actually, they put rams on all warships for the next 30 years. And the Monitor, of course, that turret. It's amazing what these two ships do. You know, and the men that served on those vessels knew that for the rest of their lives, that by merely saying, "I fought in Hampton Roads," was an open sesame to the hearts and minds of their countrymen, whether North and South. I will tell you, though, those ships changed the Civil War, proving it's a war of technology. They changed naval warfare, and we look at awe at the men who designed, built, and served on them. So, in the words of Franklin Buchanan, I just want to remind you all always to sink before surrender. Thank you. Huzzah! All righty, you know, I left out a lot of stuff, so, yes, sir.
How close did the Monitor come to piercing the armor on the Virginia?
Never. Never. There's one time where Word and thinks they break a iron plate, but I have to tell you, the damage of the Virginia, all is from the Cumberland. The Monitor does not do any real damage. They can't see what they're looking at, and because they can't see, they're not firing effectively. When the Virginia is aground, part of her hull is showing, and they never fire at her hull because they can't see it. So actually, the next class of monitors, the Passaic-class monitor, will have the pilot house on top of the turret.
Right.
And so that way they can, you know, have good visual and improve their firepower. But the problem with the Monitor also, it just has two guns. So it doesn't have a good rate of fire either. And also the 11-inch Dahlgrens, well, they'll eventually have twin turreted monitors, but that still is not enough firepower. And they will actually put 15-inch Dahlgrens on them, which have greater stopping power. They're so worried about a damage within the turret, they have to fire half powder charges. So that's another reason why there's no damage, no major damage to the Virginia. Okay, yes, ma'am?
Are there any remnants of the Virginia at the Maritime Museum?
You mean pieces of Holy Grail? Yes, 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 there are. The wheels, some iron plate. Actually, at the Museum of the Confederacy, her drive shafts there, her chains are there. They made canes of the wood of the Merrimack. That's what they'll call it after the war. They'll make horseshoes from the iron that they scrap. They actually scrapped the ship in from 1867 all the way through 1876. And they make all sorts of mementos. You still could have bought them in the 1920s. And I got three canes and a bunch of horseshoes and all sorts of. I have this little shrine. Yes.
The iron, was it an alloy of steel or was it?
No, it was rolled iron plate. Yeah, so they had not. There is steel. In fact, when the Virginia goes back into dry dock, you know, John Mercer Brook says, "Well, what are we going to do to sink the Monitor?" So he actually will design a new ram because he's got the plans and he knows the hull of the Monitor is only 1-inch iron plate. So he develops a 12-foot-long ram with a squared steel tip because he knows he can go under the iron plate and puncture a hole, and the Monitor would have gone down. But, of course, they never fight, you know. So, again, and they have a couple of chances, April 11th, May 8th, but it just doesn't happen. Yes, sir? They will. Very difficult. They have to rely on the bad transportation railroad system of the South. They actually have to compete with the Army. So in essence, they'll eventually come up with an idea that they run them down to Weldon, North Carolina, then they change them from one rail to another one that takes them up to Portsmouth. And it just takes a lot of time. Now, William Webb is going to be assigned as the official iron rail expert for the Virginia to make sure that iron gets there. And that's a problem with the building of all Confederate ironclads throughout the war, getting the iron to the work sites and rolling the iron plate. Yes, sir. Yes, the Cassetti is a French warship that's in the harbor. They all know that everyone's building these ironclads. So no one has fought ironclad to ironclad. So that's why the French are in there. The English aren't there that day, but they'll come in afterwards. And there are actually three foreign ships in Hampton Roads until the Virginia is blown up. So there's a great deal of interest because this is a new style of naval warfare. Actually, Lord Pageant, Lord of the Admiralty, will announce to Parliament, you know, whereas we had 692 ships, we now only have two, because the English are building two ironclads, the Warrior and the Black Prince. And the Warrior is a fabulous ship, 4.5-inch iron hull construction, backed by 24 inches of teak. She's got 80-pounder Armstrong guns on her. So what she couldn't blow out of the water because of her engines, she could go 18 knots. So what she couldn't blow out of the water, she could sure outrun, you know. So, but they only have two of them, right? And so that's a great concern and creates a naval race. Yes, sir?
Buchanan also commanded the ironclad in Mobile Bay, right?
Dadgum right. He is elevated to the rank of admiral, and he will go down and take command of the Mobile Bay Squadron, and actually he'll use the Tennessee as his flagship, which some say is one of the better Confederate ironclads. She has 6 inches of iron plate. However, old Buchanan, when Farragut runs past Fort Morgan and Gaines, right, Tecumseh goes down, but Farragut doesn't care, you know, damn the torpedoes, yeah, right? And they run past there. The Tennessee is so slow, he can't get there to stop them. And so they go into the anchorage into Mobile Bay, where ships waited to get into port. And Buchanan goes after him. You know, Farragut sees him coming. He says, I didn't think old Buck was such a fool. And he orders his men to breakfast, right? Because he knows how long it's going to take him to get there. Finally, when he gets there, the Union ships, you know, Buchanan tries to ram them. It's not successful, and they start ramming him. Actually, the Chickasaw, twin-turreted monitor, has 15-inch guns on board. She pounds the casemate of the Tennessee to such an extent, it breaks and showers the deck with splinters. You know, Buchanan said at the beginning of the battle, we are going to fight, we're going to sink before surrender. And if I'm wounded or killed, just lay me down the side and keep on fighting. Well, a big splinter goes into Buchanan's leg. They lay him down on the side, and they surrender. You know, actually, I'll tell you, Buchanan is taken to the Warrington Navy Yard in Pensacola, and there the doctors are real concerned. That's the same leg he was wounded in before, you know, and they're afraid the infection might be setting in, and so because he's an admiral, they give him the option to decide whether he wants it amputated or not, and they say, Admiral Buchanan, your wound is so terrible, we think we should amputate. What do you want us to do? And Buchanan purportedly said, you captured it, you decide. Yes, sir. Can I get rid of this?
You said their vision was restricted in the monitor. Wasn't their hearing also restricted? I can imagine the concussion.
Huh?
Huh? Yeah, right.
Actually, the rule was, when you're getting ready to fire, open your mouth and lean back. And that wasn't very good. And I'll tell you, Casey Jones walks and... So Casey Jones walks up and down the Virginia's gun deck saying, stay away from the shield, you know, and because you just think a 160-pound shot being hurled against the iron side, you know, it's a big clang. And the same thing's happening to the monitor. So, they can't hear. Now, the Virginia, they have good vision. They have a conical pilot house at the forward right above the 7-inch Brook pivot gun. Plus, during the battle of March 8th, Buchanan stays in the hatchway looking around, you know, because he wants to see what's going on. Actually, Raleigh Colson has his brigade at Ragged Island, which is jeez, right over here. And he sees, he untethered, that's right, like a balloon. And he sees the Virginia go towards the Cumberland, but there are a cloud of smoke. He can't tell what's going on, right? And then he sees the Cumberland's mass wave. And that's when he knows that the Virginia has damaged the Cumberland. But, you know, visibility was very, very bad. So, but the Virginia had it up on the monitor for visibility. Yes?
Can you tell me a little more about what happened
with
Green, that 21-year-old?
Oh, well. Yes, he does. He serves throughout the rest of the war. And, of course, when they put out the Battle and Leader series in the post-Civil War era, Green writes an article called "I Was in the Monitor's Turret," and he makes some statements in that article that some of the other crew members disagree with, and so they say they're going to expose him as a liar, right? And that he didn't help word into his stateroom, and he couldn't have. But what he's saying is, you know, he was there, and he was there. So Green committed suicide. You know, he did. But you look at pictures of Green. He looks dark and pensive. So, and actually, William Keeler said that the man never smiled. The man had a darkness about him, but he knew his work and did his work well.
He was
21 in 1862. Right. He doesn't commit suicide until 1883. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and he stays in the Navy. But he is tainted forever because everyone says, why didn't you go after the monitor? Or the Merrimack, excuse me. Why didn't you do that? And Green says, my orders were to defend the Minnesota. That's what I did. The pilot house is blown off, you know, and he did what he was told to do. But other people said, well, there was a more venturesome officer. They would have gone after him. Just like no one questioned Jones going back. But everyone said, well, if Buchanan would have been there, he would have sunk the Minnesota. You know, he wouldn't have worried about the monitor. Let the monitor do whatever he wants. Just go over there and sink that daggum ship because you knew you could sink it. The Virginia actually sank a tug next to the Minnesota on March 9th known as the Dragon and just blew her up, shot through her boiler. She sank right away. But Green did commit suicide. You know, all these people have different, you know, they all witnessed this change in history, and actually 25,000 people watched the battle. Hampton Roads is an amphitheater, right? There are 15,000 Union soldiers. There are 15,000 Confederate soldiers. There's 10,000 citizens in Norfolk and Portsmouth. So the estimates are at least 25,000 people. Actually, one person said every oyster skiff, every boat, imagine, came out and hung out around Craney Island just to see what was going on. I mean, it was history in the making. Just like some of y'all remember watching the moon launch, right? Or landing on the moon. You know, I wanted to go to bed. My mom said, you got to stay up and see this, you know. So what? Yes?
I've always had trouble reconciling how we delayed so much with developing these type of ships, seeing what Europe was doing. Why do you think they didn't come?
Well, because we had actually invested in what is called the Stevens Battery Scheme in 1848. We had actually built two steam or iron-hulled warships for the Great Lakes, the Michigan and the Missouri. The Missouri burns very quickly, and the Michigan still stays in service until the 1920s. But we're not as keen on iron hull construction as the British are. But that doesn't make it an ironclad unless you make it thick enough. Well, the Stevens family of Hoboken, New Jersey, say, we're going to build an ironclad. The Navy gives them $200,000, but they keep changing it. It's never done. And finally, when it's done, it becomes, the Navy won't accept it. The United States Revenue Marine Service accepts it as the Naugatuck. And it has a 100-pounder gun, but it's in parapet. In other words, it serves in the open air. So we thought that we didn't know we were going to have a civil war. So we just thought we'd let the Europeans kind of play around with it and figure out really what technology is going to go where, because we're rather parsimonious when it comes to, you know, in peacetime funding our military. So, and that's the way it is. Yes, sir.
What's the status of the engine that's being cured and everything at the museum?
You have to realize, Like just the turret alone, the turret has 8 layers of 1-inch iron plate, so all that salt got inside of it. And the same thing with the engine system. So slowly but surely, as we can confirm that the rust and the salts are all out of it until they can be actually put on display. Some things are much easier to do, copper, brass, but when it comes silver, but when it comes to anything iron, you are in serious trouble. And I'm not going to quote what I heard, but because it keeps changing. But it's going to be several years, several more years. But you have an iconic item that will, you know, change naval warfare. Yes, sir.
Do they have a way of adjusting the elevation of the guns
in the monitor
for the roll? I mean, did they actually have to wait until the roll hit a certain point?
Well, that's what they would do, without a doubt. There was no rolling when the Virginia and the Monitor fought. The waves were pretty smooth. And so the Virginia couldn't really operate in rough water anyway. Neither could the Monitor. You know, one Monitor that was down off Charleston, the Weehawken, they have their hatches open, and a ship goes by sending a wake that comes over the Weehawken, and the Weehawken sinks in 90 seconds. Yeah. I mean, you know, they're just... I would not have served on a monitor. I'll just throw that out, you know. Yes.
The Confederacy's limited ability to produce steel affect their production of iron plate?
Well, production of iron, because these are not made of steel. They're made of iron. Well, it limits them quite a bit. And it slows many of their ironclad projects. Tredegar will also have Skokum and Markham in Atlanta will start making iron. They start making iron also in Selma that can go to the ironclads. But because they can't get the iron to them, nor effective engine systems, that's why the Mississippi and the Louisiana in New Orleans are destroyed. They are almost finished. And I'll tell you, had they been finished, Farragut was not going past those forts. Because one of them, Louisiana, was designed to have 14 guns. She had 2 engine systems, a paddle wheel, center line paddle wheel, and then 3 screw propellers. I mean, but they couldn't get the engines to work right. So she's a floating battery when the Farragut's fleet goes by. And so several others are destroyed on the stocks. There's one building in Tarboro that's burned because they can't get supplies down to them. It delays the production of the Albemarle, but the Albemarle finally is finished just in time to be the second most successful ironclad. I could talk 20 hours about that stuff, but in other words, yes, what you know, Zebulon Vance, governor of North Carolina, you know, he sets up the Ladies Gunboat Association, right, and he will actually say, well, we're going to have iron for our own ships. If they're not going to provide it to us, we're going to get it ourselves. So he actually organizes, you know, there are all these railroads going to like New Bern, which is captured by the Federals. He says, those railroads go into alien country, right? And so that's where they get their railroad, their iron from. They pull up the T-rails, send them up to Richmond, have them rolled into iron plate. But I'll tell you, the Confederates are so desperate, the Arkansas, which was laid down in Memphis, but because the Federals are coming down, they burn her sister ship, then they take her up to Yazoo and finish her up. The engines that run the sawmill that help finish it, that's what runs the ship. Okay, so they're not good engines, right? The iron is T-rails put back to back, okay? I mean, they don't roll that plate. And they don't even finish the iron plating to the stern of the casemate. And they make it like this instead of sloped because they don't have a way to really work the iron when you're at Yazoo City and the Yankees are coming, you know? And so it's pretty stuff, okay? If there are not any other questions, I would like to tell you that I really appreciate, number one, the opportunity to be here with you all and to share great tales of Civil War at Sea. Furthermore, I want to thank you all ever so much for your $150 donation to the Big Bethel Battlefield. It's a small park, 3 acres, but we have the last bit of earthwork left from Big Bethel. We've received funding to create the park, the fences, the signs, and we actually had we have a new Union Monument that was brought down last year that the folks up in Vermont, New York raised $30,000 for, and it's really been a great project, and the support from groups like yours really make a big difference to places like Big Bethel that have often forgotten, but yet are so important in the course of the war that we are so interested in. So I thank you for that. And I want to just remind you to sink before you surrender.
Amen. Huzzah!